All right, Alexander. So we have the scene here, the scenario set. Tsar Nicholas on his way back to St. Petersburg. The train never makes it back to St. Petersburg. And from what we understand, the reports that we're getting, the Tsar has stepped down. He's abdicated
He's
his
not
throne.
only ab absolutely, he's not only abdicated, but he's left leaving behind him a absolutely disastrous constitutional and political vacuum. And this isn't entirely of his making, by the way. Lots of people have played a role in creating it, but he's abdicated. He abdicated also on behalf of his son, and that is very strange. And one wonders how he did that. And why he did that, and whether he has actually the legal authority to do it. I mean, how can he abdicate on behalf of his son? I mean, surely that's for his son himself to decide. Remember, Alexei now is, a growing child. He's not perhaps ready to assume the throne. He's only a very little boy. But anyway, I mean, it's not for the Tsar, one would have thought, to abdicate on behalf of his son, but he did. Then he sought to appoint his brother, the Grand Prince Michael, to take over. But of course, what has happened is that Michael has been persuaded to reject the monarchy. So the result is that Russia is without a Tsar. Russia is also without a parliament because the Duma, the Russian Parliament, was prorogued during the political crisis that we're going to discuss shortly, and nobody seems to have wanted to bring it back into session. And since only the Tsar, under the Russian Constitution, is able to bring the Duma, the Parliament, back into session, and since there is now no Tsar, the Parliament has no legal basis to reconvene and reconstitute itself, so Russia has no Parliament, and Russia has, in my opinion, no legitimate government either, because we're going to come to this in some detail. But a group of liberal politicians have come together, people very much connected with the oligarchs that we were talking about, the people who run those voluntary associations, who run the war economy, and who were represented in the Duma with that so-called progressive bloc, which the liberals were putting together and which were agitating against the Tsar. Anyway, a group of political leaders from that bloc have declared themselves to be the provisional government of Russia. But they were not appointed to that role by the Tsar. There is now no Tsar who can appoint them, and they're not being appointed or elected to that post by the Parliament because the Parliament does not exist. So this entity that calls itself the Provisional Government of Russia has no legal standing what at all. It has no legal basis in the Russian constitutional and legal system. And it functions at the moment purely because everyone so far is accepting it as Russia's government. And as a result, it is pretending that it is. Now, this is a disastrous situation for a country in the midst of a war and an economic crisis to find itself in. But it is the result of this extraordinary set of intrigues. Which led to the Tsar's abdication and to the events which have happened in St. Petersburg, as I will continue, by the way, to call Russia's capital. Officially, it's now called Petrograd, in St. Petersburg over the last few weeks. And I think before we deal with those, again, it's important to remember where we left off in our last discussion. At that point, Rasputin had been murdered. The Tsar had stopped the investigation into his murder. It was clear that a head of steam was building up. It was clear that the situation in the capital was spiralling out of control. And the Tsar took the extraordinary and disastrous decision to leave the capital, go to military headquarters in this far-off, isolated place, Mogilev. And as we see, and as we discussed in that previous programme that we've done, as a result of his doing that, the whole situation in St. Petersburg has collapsed behind him.
Yeah, but okay, so that's where we left off. The situation in St. Petersburg and in all major cities in Russia is very bad. On the domestic front, things are spiraling out of control. What prompted the Tsar, though, to, once again, he left St. Petersburg, goes to the front lines. What prompted him to leave the front lines and to head back towards St. Petersburg? And why did the train stop where it stopped? Why did it not fulfill its journey and get back to St. Petersburg? I mean, there are a lot of protests going on. A lot of people are out in the streets. Factories are closed. There's talk of some sort of revolution, something taking place, and a lot of it is coming from the Bolsheviks, this Bolshevik group, and Lenin. Is Lenin back? Are the Bolsheviks looking to start a revolution? Are the people with them? What prevented the Tsar from getting back to the seat of power? Who stopped him? What stopped him? Is this some sort of conspiracy? Are various forces colluding? I mean, what is going on here? Because where we left off, he was on the front lines. All of a sudden, now he's returning back, but he doesn't make it back. He's not allowed to get back. And it seemed like he was deceived or pressured into abdicating. Maybe he doesn't have the right information either, because he's kind of cut off from what's really happening in St. Petersburg. There's a lot of gray area here. But one thing is certain, he has abdicated. I mean, this is confirmed.
Absolutely. He is abdicated. And of course, you put your finger on the whole problem, because what has happened is that there was a protest wave and a strike wave in St. Petersburg. It is essential to understand that it was entirely confined to St. Petersburg. Up to now, there have been no major protests or strikes or factory closures anywhere else in Russia. This was localized in St. Petersburg itself. So, in theory, it could have been contained there, but it wasn't, and the Tsar was unable to return to the capital because the liberal politicians that we've been talking about seized on this protest wave to deceive first the military and then him, in order to pressure him into abdicating. Now, we need to first of all look at this protest wave. And the thing to understand about it is that the liberals had no role in it. I'm going to discuss who I think was running it shortly. But the thing to say, and it comes back to this problem of the fact that nobody is running properly, has been running properly, the supply situation in Russia, so that the cities have been running short of food, St. Petersburg especially. The government hasn't been doing that properly. The military haven't been doing that. There's no effective prime minister. There was no effective prime minister. Prince Galitsyn, who we're going to talk about, is an amiable lightweight. He doesn't have that kind of strength of personality to take control of the supply situation. So in St. Petersburg, unavoidably and inevitably, prices of bread started to rise, food shortages started to grow, protests as a result started to take off, and there have also been raids by angry people on bakeries. And what has also started to happen, is that large numbers of protesters started to congregate in a central square, Uspensky Square, which is near the big railway station. Now, that was bad enough, but in and of itself, it should not have generated a political crisis. What then happened is that on top of that, those protests, the management of the Putilov factory, which is the single biggest factory in St. Petersburg. In fact, it is the biggest factory by far. It is one of the biggest heavy industry factories in the country, and it is vital for the war effort. The management of that factory took the extraordinary decision by themselves, without consulting the government, which, as I said, has no real grasp over the country's war economy, or indeed the voluntary associations. They decided to, because of a internal work dispute, to lock out the entire workforce. We're talking about tens of thousands of people. So the result is, on top of a strike, of a protest wave, much of which was led by women, we now have thousands of angry workers on the streets because they've been locked out of their jobs. So this created an even bigger protest wave in St. Petersburg itself. And it's become increasingly clear as the protest wave continued and started to spread across the city, with more and more factories joining in, with workers from the factories starting to join in, that there is some degree of organisation behind it. Now, there's much debate about this. I have absolutely no doubt at all that the people who are played the key organisational role in this protest wave was Lenin's organisation. People like Alexander Shliapnikov, who is the major political activist, who is part of Lenin's party in St. Petersburg, and people like Vyacheslav Scriabin, the man who is known as Molotov, the hammer. These are extremely well-organized activists working in the factories. Now, I know that I'm in this somewhat on my own. A lot of people are saying that the Bolsheviks have been scattered. Most of their leaders are in prison or in exile. None of the prominent people of the Bolsheviks are in St. Petersburg, and that it's a spontaneous protest and a spontaneous protest movement that has been happening. I think this is a complete misunderstanding of the dynamics of protests. You don't need big names. What you need are organisers, people who are present in the factories, people who are, if you like, playing a rallying role on the shop floor, spreading propaganda, talking to workers, recruiting workers in their various organisations, and are therefore able to bring them out on strike and in a protest of this nature. And in this respect, Lenin's organisation has been functioning very effectively in St. Petersburg for a long time now, and operates on a completely different scale from any other organisation of this nature in the city. So I have no doubt at all that it is these activists, Lenin's people on the ground, who were playing the big organisational role in these protests. Now, what then happened, as I said, we have all these people out protesting, more and more factories closing. But this is not something that is completely new. It's happened before in St. Petersburg. There was a similar protest wave last winter, and on that occasion, it was brought under control. What has created this collapse this time is that we have had this political crisis that we've been talking about, this sense that without the Tsar, nobody is really in control. And the kind of people who were in charge of trying to control the events in the streets, instead of being well-organized, well-trained police officials, the Interior Ministry, remember, is run by this man, Protopopov, who is universally considered to be incompetent. They have been mainly soldiers, people who have generals, people who have no real experience of controlling crowds. They brought out troops into the city. They kept them standing around doing nothing very much through the intense cold. At one point, an order was given to fire on some of the protesters. The soldiers carried out the order, but were apparently extremely upset about doing so. And you started to see, as a result, mutinies starting to spread in some of the regiments in the capital. Again, if the Tsar had been there in a position to rally the military, speak to the soldiers, give guidance and instructions to people, take effective control of the situation, it could have been contained. But he wasn't there. Also, it's important to say that the desertions, the mutinies, essentially were confined to the infantry regiments. The cavalry regiments, which are, there's lots of them in St. Petersburg, all the indications are that they continued to be loyal to the Tsar and to the government. They are better organized for dealing with protest crowds and dispersing protest crowds, but nobody gave them instructions to do that. So the result is that without clear instructions, without clear guidance, the military in the capital started to disintegrate. And then we started to see the way the political crisis began to operate within the capital itself, because the liberals began to put increasing pressure on the government. The prime minister, Galitsyn, who is a lightweight, as I said, panicked. He ordered the dissolution of the Duma. He did it on the Tsar's authority, but without consulting the Tsar himself. And the result was that the Duma dissolved. And the result is that, of course, there was no political structure, no parliamentary political structure in the capital able to take control of the situation. So we've had this chaos in the capital. Now, Nicholas, when he heard about it, as you rightly said, he got on the train. He started to head towards the capital. He started to contact the various military commanders around the country about deploying troops to the capital to restore order. But what then happened is that the Speaker of the Duma, Mr. Rodzianko, then started to contact the generals himself and started to contradict Nicholas's orders. And he started to tell the generals that Nicholas has lost control of the situation in the capital, that the situation in the capital is in chaos, which was true. But he also gave the generals the idea that the Duma was still in existence, the parliament was still in existence, and that he, as Speaker of the Parliament, was ready and able to take control. And he pressured the generals. And remember, he's able to inform the generals about what's happening in St. Petersburg. They weren't sure what was going on in St. Petersburg because communications have essentially broken down. He persuaded the generals that the Duma had lost confidence in Nicholas, that the Duma is in a position to take over, that he, Rodzianko, is in a position to take over. And he persuaded the generals that for the sake of the success of the war effort, they should put pressure on the Tsar, on Nicholas, to abdicate. So the generals stopped the train. They were able to send one of their leaders, one of the generals, to meet Nicholas. The general told Nicholas that he had to abdicate, and abdicate he did.
It's an incredible story. Under what authority did Rodzianko claim the ability to rule? Okay, he was Speaker of the House in the Duma, but why did the generals believe him?
Well,
how come there was not a general to say, you know what, okay, as Speaker of the Duma, even if the Duma is in session, even if I believe it hasn't been dissolved and it's in session, why do you become essentially the leader of Russia. Why do you administer the government? I mean, how come the generals didn't assume power in that instance?
Very good questions. Excellent questions. One general was skeptical about the whole thing, and that was General Kuropatkin, who was previously Russia's defense minister during the Russo-Japanese War and is still a major military figure, but he is far away from the capital. He is, in effect, running things in the central regions of the empire. So he wasn't able to intervene. What authority did Rodzianko have to do with this? He had none. Then doesn't seem as if he consulted widely. And, of course, he misled the generals into thinking that the Duma was still in session and that he was acting on behalf of the Duma, which, of course, he wasn't. In fact, he was acting entirely on his own without engaging in any wider consultations. And the assumption is that he was the person that he was hoping, in effect, to get himself appointed some kind of minister president or leader of the country, have either the Alexei or perhaps Michael appointed Tsar, and that he would be the person in overall charge. I mean, if so, he seems to have miscalculated disastrously. But the reason the generals listened to him and the reason they went with him is because he told them that he was in a position to take control, that the Duma was in a position to take control, that he was going to appoint a government, and that that was the only government that had the confidence and the support in St. Petersburg and the country to keep Russia in the war and to ensure that the war economy functioned, continued to function properly. Remember the great fault line is that the government lost control of the war economy. It fell under the control of the oligarchs who had been running it via the so-called voluntary associations. Rodzianko is known to be connected to some of the people in those voluntary associations. So the generals, whose major priority is to win the war, they thought that Rodzianko, as the new leader of the country, would have the support of the oligarchs, would have the support of, would be able to run the war economy effectively, would be able to get rid of the Tsar, who was clearly, you know, obstructing the efficient conduct of the war. And as a result, they went with what he suggested. Now, as I said, one general saw through it all, but he was far away. The others, not, it must be said, politically very sophisticated people. I mean, they're generals. They're not people who engage much in politics. They didn't really understand very much about what was going on.
Why did Nicholas abdicate so easily? I mean, how come Nicholas didn't question what was being told to him on the train and just say, look, let me get back and let me sort this out. And if it is as you describe it, then I will abdicate. If it's not, then, well, I'm going to take whatever necessary action I need to take. I mean, it seems like obviously there's a breakdown everywhere. But once again, I go back to Nicholas and I say, you know, you are still Tsar. On that train, you are still Tsar. Why did you so freely give it up? Why did you just let it go?
This is the biggest unanswered question. It's the great mystery. I mean, it has to be said, first of all, that if Nicholas is faced, as he was, with a united demand for the military that he stepped down, that's a very difficult situation to be in. And one can understand why, with the military now uniting behind Rodzianko, in effect, he found it difficult to withstand that kind of pressure. But one has to say something, which is that Nicholas himself has looked increasingly distracted over the last few months. He seems increasingly disengaged. We discussed in our previous program how his decision to leave St. Petersburg at this critical time almost indicated a man who was running away from a situation he was finding unbearable. And people who watched him over the course of that meeting on the train with the generals, with the officials who were telling him to abdicate, also that his whole demeanour was really very strange, that he seemed completely passive, that he seemed unemotional, that he seemed even in some ways unaffected by what had happened. And I know that there are some people who feel that he was almost relieved. He almost embraced this with a sense of relief. He's so sick and exhausted by all the intrigue that's been swirling around him, something that he simply can't stand, that he felt that with the generals all telling him to go, with the politicians all telling him to go, this was his opportunity finally to be free of all this mess and to walk away from it. I have to say, if that was the case, then he failed Russia. I mean, he needed to go to St. Petersburg to take charge of the situation, to assume responsibility. And of course, when there, he could have made any number of decisions. I mean, he might have decided at that point that the moment had come for him to go. But it was incumbent upon him to make sure that if he left, he left something in his place. He didn't do that. But he seems to have been worn down by these years of pressure that he's been under ever since the assassination of Stolypin all those years ago.
I agree with your assessment. I mean, we've always talked about how Nicholas never truly felt comfortable being the Tsar. Not that he did a poor job, not that he did a great job, but I mean, he never got into it like his father, you know, settled into it. And yes, he was worn down over the years by constant palace intrigue. But he should have gone back and sorted things out. It's the part that really bothers me. Even if it is the generals, they still work for you and they still take orders from you at the end of the day. And if you had insisted to go back, well, then the generals would have had to make a decision. Yeah. What do we do with now that the Tsar is ordering us to stand down and to let him go back to St. Petersburg? What do we do? You know, what's our place in history now? Instead, he just kind of... It seemed like that was his get out card. That was his way to just say, "I'm finally out. I'm finally out of this," and you know, let the chips fall where they may. But I'm very worried as to what's going to happen now, because obviously you don't have a strong presence in the government, even if it is Rodzianko. Whoever is running the show now obviously doesn't have the support of the people, doesn't have the support of the institutions, and you have a power vacuum, and that power vacuum is going to be filled by the most clever, most shrewd political force out there. And my mind turns to Lenin. I don't think there's anyone at Lenin's caliber at this moment in time, and he's going to be the person that will fill that vacuum.
Absolutely. We'll talk about Lenin shortly, but I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if he'd called the bluff, if he'd kept a level head, if he said to the generals, "Well, just a moment, please, I'm the Tsar, you take your orders from me. I mean, you can't come along and tell me these sort of things, and who's talking to you and telling you all these things?" I mean, that's what he should have said. He should have said, "I'm going to go to St. Petersburg. This is my job. You stay out of this. I'm going to go and sort these things out, and you should carry out my orders." I mean, that's what a proper Tsar should have done. Now, in my opinion, Nicholas...
Real quick, before you go... Do you think the generals in that situation that you laid out, what do you think the generals would have done?
They would have backed down. I mean, what would they have done? I mean, they wouldn't have arrested the Tsar.
Do you think his life was threatened there in front of the generals?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's no evidence that it was. But I mean, again, I mean, you know, we're talking about the generals. We're not talking about evil people. They're not the kind of people, I think, who would have murdered the Tsar. And, you know, murder him for Rodzianko? I hardly think it likely, actually. I think he could have insisted at least on going back to St. Petersburg. And when he was in St. Petersburg, he would have acted as a point of stability. And who knows? I mean, you know, forces might have started to rally to him in that case. But he didn't do it. He didn't have that force of personality to dominate the situation and to take charge. Now, if we talk about Nicholas as Tsar, I think it's important to say that he was not a bad Tsar in many respects. He ran foreign policy effectively. I mean, he understands foreign policy. He knows how to forge alliances. He's developed this alliance with Britain and France. He's interested in these things. He knows a lot about military matters. So the military, the state of the military, has improved radically over the course of his reign. And 1916, as we have seen, has been a year of victory for the Russian army. And 1917, this is the extraordinary thing about it, was looking to be even better. There is a major offensive being prepared to be launched against the Germans. All the indications were that that would go well. So he is good at those things that interest him. He's not interested in economics. He doesn't really understand those. He needs technical people to help him. And he hasn't had many of those that he can rely upon. And of course, he detests intrigue. He detests party politics, and he's very shy. Problems, I suspect, that go back to his childhood. He's very shy. And as a result, he doesn't have the force of personality to dominate and overawe those around him, as his father once did. So he's good at those things that interest him, where he can become involved, where he can take an interest. He's got a very strong scientific interests. And these are not, you know, these are not amateurish. He takes a serious and informed interest in science. He's presided over an extraordinary period of cultural boom in Russia. So those things he understands, those things interest him, those things he does well. But politics, political intrigue, dealing with conspiracies, that sort of thing, he doesn't like, it doesn't interest him. And in the end, rather than confront it, he walked away. Now, the other big mystery is why, of course, he abdicated on behalf of his son. And we had no real explanations about this. I suspect, though it's not been admitted, that the people who persuaded him to abdicate pushed him to do the same thing with respect to his son as well. And I think partly the reason that was done, and partly the reason why Nicholas might have gone along with that, is because there was concern that if he did abdicate and his son became Tsar, the Empress would have become regent. And I think there is so much hostility to the Empress within court society in Russia that Nicholas didn't want to expose his wife to those kind of pressures. And he was probably quite easily persuaded that if she did find herself in that role, the situation in the capital would become even more unstable. So I think that was why he did that. But he did try, and this is important to say, he did suggest certain things, which had they been done, had his advice been followed, they would have, I think, repaired some of the damage. So he did apparently offer to reconvene the Duma, the parliament. And this is where it becomes extremely interesting, because along with the generals who met the Tsar, there was a very curious politician, a character called Vladimir Guchkov, who's a former speaker of the Duma and is known to be a compulsive intriguer. And behind Guchkov as well, there's obviously liberals. Anyway, they don't seem to have wanted Nicholas to reconvene the Duma. And bear in mind, that might be because the Duma has a conservative majority. So they didn't want a conservative majority Duma, one which is pro-monarchist, reconvened. So they didn't agree to Nicholas's suggestion that before he abdicated, he reconvened the Duma. And the second thing was that they told him that they were going to set up a provisional government. He offered, as Tsar, to appoint it. In other words, to legalise its appointment. And again, they refused. So I think, again, the reason they didn't want that is because they didn't want a situation where a Duma appointed by the Tsar might be dismissed by a successor Tsar. They wanted, in effect, both Nicholas out of the way and Alexis, his son, out of the way as well. Now, what then happened, and this is where it becomes very interesting, because, of course, reports then reach the capital that Nicholas has abdicated, that Alexis is not going to become Tsar, and that the Duma is not going to be reconvened, and that the provisional government has not been is not being appointed by the Tsar. So at that point, according to the law of succession, Nicholas's brother, the Grand Prince Michael, is supposed to become Tsar. And what happens is a deputation of liberal politicians goes to see Michael. And they're led by two people. One is Kerensky. You remember him? He was the person who carried out that incendiary investigation into the incident in the Lena gold mines just before the start of the war. And he's a sort of, tub-thumping populist orator. And the other was Miliukov, who is perhaps the best known liberal in the Duma, perhaps one of the more conservative and level-headed liberals. Now, they come along and they meet Michael. And Miliukov says to Michael, the Tsar has abdicated. Alexis isn't going to take over. You are now the Tsar and you must act as Tsar. But the other members of this delegation, these other people there, Kerensky especially, insist to Michael that he cannot be Tsar and they're not prepared to support him. So Michael is then given the impression that he has no support from the political class in Russia, and he decides to abdicate as well. It seems, or rather to refuse to become Tsar, it seems that he too offered to appoint the provisional government, and these liberal politicians that we are talking about refused to accept that. So Nicholas abdicates on behalf of Alexis, who therefore doesn't become Tsar. Michael is pushed into abdicating as well. There is no Tsar. There is no parliament. The government has not been appointed by the Tsar, has no legal authority. It's not been elected by the Duma because the Duma doesn't exist. And there are thousands of men in the streets of St. Petersburg, many of them armed, and they're now joined by the soldiers who have deserted their regiments. So it's an incredibly dangerous situation. And one does have to ask oneself, what exactly are the liberals thinking? The reason they've set this whole thing up is that they want a government completely controlled by themselves. They don't want a conservative-dominated parliament in which they don't have a majority, and they don't want a Tsar who might act as a check on them. So they've finally managed to create this government entirely made up of themselves. It's in theory headed by this man, Prince Lvov, who is the head of the voluntary association in Moscow, and who is essentially a lightweight and is known to be a front man for the Moscow-based oligarchs, for people like the banker Ryabyshinsky. So they've created this government, but this government has no legal basis. It is created without any authorization either from the Tsar or from the parliament. It simply exists, and it exists in a situation, as I said, where there are thousands of men on the streets, thousands of people on the streets, people who are, let's put it like this, not liberals. And there was apparently a famous incident where the appointment of the government was announced, and one of the people in the crowd asked one of the people in the government, who appointed you? And that person who was asked that question, who was in fact Miliukov, he was only able to say, the revolution. The revolution appointed me. So effectively admitting that Russia is now in a state of revolution, and we have a bunch of liberal oligarchs and their sidekicks trying to ride the storm.
Right. We've been documenting this throughout our whole coverage of all of what's been going on in Russia, and that is that the liberals have wanted the monarchy to dissolve.
Yeah.
For years, if not decades, yeah. Now, and it looks like they found their opening. They thought they found their opening, and they took it. And unfortunately, yes. Nicholas played along with it, as did Michael. I mean, okay, they got what they want, but the question now is, in this type of situation where no one has been given the authority by the people to govern, the person that will be governing the country going forward is going to be the person that has the most muscle, that has the most might. Might makes right in this type of a scenario.
Absolutely.
Who's it going to be? Because,
well, good question.
You know, ballots are gone, the votes are gone, the czar is gone, there's nothing there. Now it's a matter of who has the most guns, who has the biggest guns.
Absolutely.
That's going to be who's going to run the country now.
Absolutely, because of course what the liberals have got is what they wished for. And what do people always say? Be careful what you wish for. You've got your government, your so-called provisional government. It's staffed by liberals. Kerensky is there. Miliukov is there. Prince Lvov is running it. Rodzianko did his job, but he's been kicked out. I think the fact that he played this really double game with the soldiers meant that he was damaged goods, even though he probably didn't grasp the fact that he was being used himself, actually. So what we have is this government. And of course, it has no traction with the people in the streets. And it has really no legal authority, no right to govern. And you're asking who is eventually going to take control. It seems to me there are only two institutions left in Russia that can function and that have retained any degree of cohesion. One is the military itself, and the possibility of a military dictatorship is now very real. I mean, it's not inconceivable that the generals might decide that the moment has now come, that they must take control of the situation, they must do what the Tsar wanted them to do, send troops to the capital, take control there. So it's possible we could be heading towards a military dictatorship. The other possibility is that the organization which really is able to control the streets, and to a great extent the factories too, Lenin's organization, is going to be the organization that's going to take charge. And it's important to say that Lenin's organization isn't just limited to the factories, to the workers' districts. It's started over the last few years, apparently, to operate within the military itself, especially amongst the soldiers. They've been spreading defeatism amongst the soldiers. Up to now, that's been contained, but it was contained within a political situation where there was a clearly defined government and where the military knew what it was doing. With the Tsar gone, it's not so certain that it can be contained in the way that it was. And one branch of the military already seems to have fallen essentially under Lenin's control. And I'm referring now to the Baltic Fleet, where Baltic sailors are an unusual group of people, because whilst the army tends to be recruited from the peasantry, from peasant boys, the Navy ratings are recruited from the urban working class, many of them already, of course, therefore infected by Bolshevik propaganda. They also tend to be educated. They tend to be literate because you need literate people in the ships. Quite a few of the peasants are literate too, but in the Navy, pretty much everybody is. Well, of course, they're not sitting around reading Pushkin. They're reading Lenin's propaganda, the propaganda of his party. And they're also very young. Most of the soldiers are, you know, men of, you know, reasonably mature years, but Navy ratings are mostly in their late teens and early 20s. So you have a situation where you have a bunch of people put together in the ships, and they combine working class militancy with student radicalism. They're a kind of combination of the two, except, of course, they've been really fired up and they are extremely violent. And the one thing one must say about these protests is that the protests in St. Petersburg have been largely, though not entirely, peaceful. In the fleet, in the Baltic fleet, it hasn't been that way at all. The sailors have mutinied and they've been killing their officers. And there's been extraordinary scenes of violence in the major naval base in Kronstadt and in other places on the ships. And it seems that they are very, very much now under Lenin's sway. And so we have a situation where Lenin's organization controls the streets in St. Petersburg, where he has what is perhaps not well organized, but still a military force in the Navy, which is slipping under his control, and where we have a weak government, which was appointed by no one, largely through a successful deception of the military. And the military itself is starting to become infiltrated by people who are coming under Lenin's influence. And the reports we're hearing is that Lenin, who is in Switzerland, is negotiating with the Germans. He's trying to get back to Russia. There's talk that he might be allowed by the Germans to cross Germany in a sealed train, and that if he will then arrive in Petrograd, assume control of his organisation. And then, of course, the most single-minded, ruthless politician in Russia will be in the capital at a time of crisis and revolution. So, as I said, he's prepared to cut his deals with the Germans. He's been utterly focused on what he wants to do. He's focused on power. He understands power. He has, as I said, an organisation that is loyal to him, that works for him. I have to say, this situation looks almost made for him and for his party to take power.
Yeah, the stage is set for his grand entrance.
The stage is set.
Well, this is a good place.
One has to ask also, as I said, I come back to the Liberals. They've largely created this situation. Now they go, well, we will see how they try to control it. They don't, the army doesn't like them. And I suspect that as the generals begin to understand the extent to which they were tricked, they're going to like the Liberals even less. And the workers on the streets don't support them either. And of course, we have this crisis in the Baltic fleet. So, as I said, from the point of view of the Liberals and the oligarchs, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, they didn't think too far ahead in this one, did they?
Yeah.
It's a good place to leave this this one, and we'll pick it up according to how it goes. Most likely, we'll see the return of Lenin, and let's see how it shakes out from there. All right, everybody, theduran.locals.com. Take care.